Hey everybody, it's me, your host Dacia, and you are about to hear my chat with composer Dale Trumbore about poetry and music and setting poetry to music and how poetry lends itself to music and writing poetry to music. You get the idea. Dale is great, and she even almost gets me to sing in this episode, so be prepared to either turn your speakers up or down for that moment. Anyhow, you will enjoy this episode, I know it. And when you do, make sure to subscribe to, rate us, and review us on iTunes. Okay, here we go. There's a rumor going around that classical music can be hoity-toity. But here in the classical classroom, we beg to differ.
Beethoven 5.
Isaiah is shaking with excitement.
Oh, here. I mean, there's just so many great parts of the opera.
He asked me to play his favorite spot in the first movement of the Brahms. And then he said, I started using those licks in my guitar solos.
It's how to be classical music rock stars, because there's not enough of that in this business.
Occasionally, I would plug in the mandolin to my distortion pedals.
I don't change my voice.
And talking to classical music voice.
I'm playing classical music now. I mean, it's the same 12 notes. That's what's so cool about it.
I'm Dacia Clay, a classical music newbie, and I'm trying to learn all I can about the music. Come learn with me and the classical music experts I invite into the Classical Classroom. Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Classical Classroom. I'm Dacia Clay, and joining us today from the Marketplace Studios in Los Angeles is composer Dale Trumbore. Dale's work particularly focuses on setting poems and prose by living authors to music, which we're going to talk a little bit about today. Her work has been commissioned and performed all over the U.S. and the world. She's also a writer herself. In January of 2017, Choral Arts Initiative will release an album of her works for chorus. Dale, welcome to the Classical Classroom.
I'm glad to be here. Thanks for having me.
So what are you going to be teaching me about today?
So I love writing for the voice, and usually with singing, not always, but usually if you're singing, you have to have something to sing about and you have to have some words to sing.
Uh-huh.
And so that's what led me to setting poetry in the first place. And then I also just have a love of words.
Yeah,
I like writing. I used to write poetry and I've kind of gotten away from that, but I still have this deep love for it and for the craft of just words that fit together really beautifully, and then that extra step of words that can be kind of illuminated by music and brought to life in a new way. So I'm going to be talking about what makes a poem a really good poem to set to music.
Okay.
And then I'm going to get into the process of how a composer goes about taking that poem and transforming it into a choral piece.
So talk to me about why you use living authors particularly. I mean, there are all of these great dead guys out there that you could use.
Yeah, so that's a good question. And part of that lies in the word guys you just used. There's a lot of public domain poetry. There are some wonderful female writers who are public domain, like Sarah Teasdale and Emily Dickinson, mm-hmm. who are set to music a lot. But a lot of public domain poetry, since when I say public domain, I mean prior to 1923 or so,
okay.
music that is not under copyright.
Mm-hmm.
So when you set a poem to music, you have to make sure that you have permission to use it.
Yeah.
So either it's in the public domain or you have to go to the publisher or the poet and get permission.
Ah.
Yes.
You know, I've never really thought about that. I've never, like, because, you know, I've often heard of Emily Dickinson being set to music and, like,
mm-hmm.
Oh my gosh, who is that other female author that I hear so often set to music? Anyway, she's from, like, a similar time period. You know, that one other one.
Yeah.
But it never occurred to me that part of the reason to use older writers is because of expense and the complications of using newer writing.
Yeah. So I have two reasons for liking living poetry. And one is that for me, it feels much more contemporary. It feels more of this moment, mm-hmm. and it feels newer and fresher.
Yeah.
And I'm lucky that I started working with a bunch of poets about, I think it's 6 or so years ago, and I've stayed in touch with them. And now they're the poets that I can go to, and I can go to them directly. I don't have to worry about their publisher or any of that. I can go to them and get permission from them. And if there is a publisher, they deal with the publisher. I've taken the time to kind of build a little network of poets. But the other part of that, too, is a lot of the public domain poetry has been set to music so many times, mm-hmm. so many times. And so working with living poets, usually you get to be the first one to set a poem. And then also it just feels more modern. And, yeah.
Yeah. I think that's so interesting. We don't talk a lot about the sort of practical things that form a creative work sometimes. And that you've like set about creating these relationships with people, not just for artistic reasons, but just for practical, I can use your stuff reasons.
Right. Yeah. Right. And it helps that they're wonderful people too. That's always a plus.
Yeah. So, okay. You said you've got like a little network of writers that you work with. How does that work, I guess? Like, what's your process? Do you go to one of them and say, I would like to create a music about fill in the blank topic, or do you read their work somewhere and go, oh, I like this one, can I use this?
Yeah, so sort of both, depending on the opportunity. If it's a commission, so if a chorus approaches me and says, I want a piece about America or something, or nature, the ocean, or it could be anything, then I need a very specific poem that actually fits with that theme.
Yeah.
So then I might go to a writer that I know or a bunch of writers and say, hey, do you have anything that fits this theme? But otherwise, I keep a database of poems that I know I want to set in the future, just on my computer, ready to go. So when I have an opportunity to choose a text, I go to that.
Okay. Yep. That's pretty cool. And I guess the other component is, just in addition to liking the piece of writing and it being the appropriate piece of writing, like, is there more to it? Like, how do you know that a piece of writing will work when you set it to music, or how do you know that it won't work?
Yeah, so that's a great question, because not all poems do work. And so I look for a few things that make a poem really great for setting to music. Mm-hmm. And I mentioned earlier that music has to sort of light up the poem in a new way. It has to illuminate it. Mm-hmm. And some poems, if they are, let's say it's light first, it's a really funny, short, tight little poem. It might not be a great poem to set to music, because maybe it relies on one joke and that's it.
Yeah.
And music, we'll see in some of the examples that I want to show you later, music tends to stretch out language a little bit. Mm-hmm. We usually sing words slower than we say them. So if we have something that's really, again, like one joke, it might even slow the joke down to set it to music.
Right.
But aside from that, another thing to think about is some poems have really long, complex phrases with mm-hmm. lots of clauses, and they ramble and they go on and on, kind of like this sentence is doing. And by the time you get to the end, you have no idea what's been said at the beginning. If mm-hmm. it's set to music, obviously on the page, with some poems, you can go back and you can read. If the language is like really complicated and dense, you can go back and read it, right? Or like if we were looking at a painting, say, you get the whole thing at once, right? But music, because it's a time-based art, we have to let it unfold, and we're kind of at the mercy of our ears. So that's another thing to think about, is how long are the phrases? And then the last thing I think about, too, is can I set we're going to talk about text painting, but can I take specific words or images from the poem and set them to music in a way where the music demonstrates exactly what the word is saying?
Yeah.
One of the first examples we can talk about is this classic textbook case of a really early example of text painting, which is from the Thomas Wilkes English madrigal, As Vesta Was from Latmos Hill Descending.
Oh, yeah. Let's hear it.
Yeah.
As Vesta was from Latmos Hill Descending.
So we're hearing descending and ascending. And what is he doing with the word descending and the word ascending?
Ah.
What's the melody doing?
Uh-huh.
It goes down on descending, right?
Yeah.
And it goes up on ascending. So it's a really basic, really easy to understand example of very basic text painting.
Huh.
Right? Descending, maybe the melody should go down.
Okay.
And ascending, maybe when we sing, the melody should go up.
So text painting is basically illustrating what's happening in the text through music.
Exactly.
Okay.
Yeah, and a lot of composers do this. So this, again, this piece was written in, I think, 1601. So it's an early example of a very specific word, doing something in the music to show what the word's meaning is.
Aha.
But we get this a lot. J.S. Bach does it, and we get this all the way through to contemporary poetry.
Huh.
Pretty much every composer likes to text paint when they set words to music.
So I think this is kind of a related question, because we were initially talking about form and things like that. I'm wondering, okay, so I was hanging out with a writer and professor friend of mine the other night, and she blew my mind. She told me that she sings Emily Dickinson poems to her class. Mm-hmm. First of all, I was like, well, that is awfully ballsy of you to sing in front of your class. And then I was like, why would you sing it? And she was like, oh, well, it's written in a musical form and it's meant to be sung. And I was like, what are you talking about? I am an English major. I've never heard this before. Can you talk a little bit about form and which forms lend themselves to music and what on earth my friend was talking about?
Yeah, so just like music has forms like sonata form or a rondo, poetry has forms as well, like a sonnet or a villanelle. And some of those lend themselves more easily to music than others. But usually in older poetry, if the poem is in a form, we have rhyme and we have meter.
Uh-huh.
So we have a sense of maybe, one example would be Stopping by Woods on a Snowy Evening. Mm-hmm. We have whose woods these are, I think I know. His house is in the village, though, right?
Uh-huh.
I'm saying it kind of in a sing-song way. But the words fall into this pattern, right? So if we were going to set it to music, the meter's already there for us.
Ah.
1, 2, 1, 2, or 1, 2, 3, 4, 1, 2, 3, 4, 1, 2, 3, 4, right?
Huh.
Whose woods these are. So obviously as a composer, especially writing contemporary music, we can kind of stretch and play with these forms when we set music. But I think as a composer, and this comes back to why I like working with living poets and free verse a lot, is poems like that can kind of lock you into music that adopts that rhythm and has the same sense of rigid meter. Yeah. And then free verse lets you go a little freer.
Huh.
So, yeah.
Okay, so if it's free verse, you know, it's you, as I'm assuming, as the composer, are then grouping the text into musically meaningful chunks.
Exactly.
Okay.
Yeah, and then I'm going to look for other things, like, are there words that keep coming back? And if there isn't rhyme at the end of every line, maybe there's internal rhyme, so words that rhyme with each other within the line, or slant rhyme, words that almost rhyme with each other.
Mm-hmm.
So I think actually a really good example to look at next of a contemporary arrangement of a hymn, we could take a look at The Road Home, and it's arranged by Stephen Paulus. And this is kind of a weird example of the music being written second. So the poet wrote the words to fit a pre-existing melody.
Oh, okay.
So just in the text, you can already hear that sense of meter that we were talking about.
Yeah.
So I can read you a little bit of the poem if you want.
Yeah.
But so it goes, tell me, where is the road I can call my own that I left, that I lost so long ago? All these years I have wandered. Oh, when will I know there's a way, there's a road that will lead me home? So you can kind of hear it starting to fit into a meter and a musicality. And there's one thing, too, before we listen to this one, I wanted to look at the word wandered and show you one more thing. Can you say that word for me?
Wandered?
Yeah.
Wandered.
So the first syllable, we tend to say higher, unless we're asking a question, which you did the first time, right?
Wandered?
But if we're just saying in a sentence, we go wandered.
Yeah.
And the first syllable is a higher pitch than the second syllable, usually.
Yeah.
Right.
Okay.
So if you were setting this to music, maybe you would set a higher note for the first syllable and a lower one. And then also with that same word, the first syllable is stressed and the second one is unstressed, right? Mm-hmm. Wandered. So maybe the first syllable would be on a strong beat and then we'd have a weaker beat.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So why don't we hear?
Yeah, let's hear an example.
Yeah. That poem is by Michael Dennis Brown.
Okay.
And again, that's kind of a weird reverse. Usually we find the poem, we set it to music, but that's kind of a cool one to look at the text by itself and hear the music already in it.
Well, and this, it strikes me, as I was listening to you talk about this, and just listening to the music, that the music that you're talking about, at least that you've talked about thus far, is... like the notes in the music and the text are very tied up together. But, you know, I was, have you ever listened to the podcast Song Exploder?
No, I've heard about it, but I haven't listened to it yet.
It's really cool. They take a piece of music, usually by a band, although they do a composer sometimes too, and they have the people talk about how they created the song, and they explode the song and take apart its parts. Well, I was listening to a band that I really like talk about how they came up with the lyrics to their song, and as I listened to the song, I thought, oh, they must have written this, you know, meaningful poem, because this is really kind of deep song, and then they must have set it to music. But in fact, what happened was they wrote this music and they just sort of started singing nonsense words and then kind of formed them into words eventually. And so, and there was very much not that relationship between the music and the words. Like they were sort of floating on top, I guess. I don't know how else to say it. So, but what you're talking about is so different than that. Like, do you ever do that? Do you ever take that approach?
I haven't really. But and the part of that's that I don't usually write my own lyrics, although that's something someday I would like to get back to doing.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's definitely, I think going the opposite way can be its own inspiring, I don't know, way to generate something creative too.
Yeah.
And as a composer, too, it's always good to have different ways to shake up your methods. Because sometimes we kind of get stuck doing one thing, and I think it's good to be open to other things that might stretch you and pull you in a different way.
Are you talking about art song? We've talked a little bit about art song on this show before. And I understand that it's music that's through written.
Yeah, through composed.
Through composed,
yeah,
thank you.
Through composed. Yeah, yeah, exactly. Yeah. That's so choral music, we tend to not call art song usually.
Oh, okay.
Usually art song is just a solo singer or maybe more singers, and usually piano, although it could be a different accompaniment. Uh-huh. But you're absolutely right. There's so many similarities, and I write art song too, and that goes through mostly the same process, and that is also through composed. So the music takes us through the entire poem and changes and doesn't necessarily have, say, a refrain that comes back.
Mm-hmm.
So if we're looking at free verse, it is probably going to be through composed. We might find little ways to come back to certain ideas. Mm-hmm. Like if a word comes back, maybe we bring back the musical idea. But yeah. In general, it is going to be through composed. So you're absolutely correct about that.
Okay. Whereas yeah. with like choral music, you might have a refrain. You might have...
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay. I see.
And a lot of choral music does, and the piece we just listened to does as well. It keeps repeating that music under the text, even though the text changes.
I feel like I cut you off a little while ago when we were talking about text painting. I started talking about something else that had popped into my head.
Oh,
did you have more
okay.
that you wanted to say about that?
Well, we could move into talking about text painting the mood of an image.
Ooh, yes.
So how we capture the mood of a piece or of a poem in a piece.
I like it.
Yes. So one poem or one piece and one poem that does this really well, I think, is Threshold of Night by Tarik O'Regan. And this is another contemporary piece. This is not an arrangement. This is a new composition written in 2006, and the poet is Kathleen Rain.
Okay.
And the first bit of the poem is, "Who stands at my door in the storm and rain on the threshold of being, one who waits till you call him in from the empty night?" So what are you getting from the mood of that?
Like
if you had to pick words.
it's a little spooky.
Yeah, right?
Yeah.
It's kind of mysterious, and there's a little bit of tension. Who
yeah.
stands at my door? You're like, what? I don't know. So let's listen
okay.
this recording and yeah.
Yeah. How this piece flows together.
Yeah. So it's very stark, right?
Yeah.
And this is some beautiful choral writing too, because he's playing with the texture. He's not just having everyone sing at once.
Right.
He's having using soloists and just a few voices at a time
uh-huh.
before he has everyone come in to create that kind of emptiness. And we have the word empty too, right?
Mm-hmm.
So it's creating this mysterious mood and imagery
yeah.
just through how he's writing for the chorus.
Yeah. You know, I have to admit that I've had a difficult time as a listener. Like I'm learning about classical music in general, but I've had a particularly difficult time with choral music. And with classical vocal music, and I don't know why exactly. I really can't pinpoint what it is, but I gotta say that was really cool.
Yeah, yeah. The Tarik O'Regan is great,
yeah.
And maybe since you have an English background, maybe the way in is through the words.
Maybe.
I know that's how it is for me, but maybe you find poems. Like poems by Emily Dickinson. Maybe you go back to the public domain poems that have been said a million times and you find a poem you really like and see if there are musical settings of it.
That's a good idea.
Yeah.
That's a really good idea. Okay, so where should we go next?
So if you want, we could talk about my music and
yeah.
how I go about setting modern poetry to
yeah.
music.
Yeah, I would like that. Let's talk about what Dale Trumbore does.
Right.
How does your process start? Like, what do you do?
So first I find the right poem. So we talked a little bit about that, right? I have to have permission. And again, that's like maybe the most important thing, because if you write a whole piece and then you don't have permission, you have to kind of throw out all of your work.
Right.
So we never want that. So I have permission. The poem is right for whatever opportunity, if I have a specific opportunity in mind, like if there is a theme for a concert, and there's not always, but if there is, it's appropriate. And then, so what I start with is I start reading the poem over and over again to see where the words, what rhythm the words start falling into. Yeah. So we talked a little bit about meter before, right? Like 3/4 and time signatures, 3/4 time, go 1/2/3, 1/2/3, right?
Yeah.
Or 4/4 time, 1/2/3/4. So the thing with contemporary poetry is it doesn't always fall into those. It doesn't necessarily stay in one meter the whole time.
Right.
So sometimes it changes meter. And that can be something, actually, it's kind of funny. Singers, well, choral singers get used to all of these poems or all of these settings of poems that stay in 3/4 or 4/4. So sometimes they're a little shocked when you ask them to change meter all the time. But that's the thing with contemporary poetry is it kind of has to be flexible in that way in order to make sense as a musical setting. Because you don't want to be putting the wrong emphasis on the wrong syllable, right?
Yeah.
You always want to have the way we sing the words reflecting more or less how we would say the words.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So, yeah. So I actually want to give you a little bit of text and ask you, given everything we've talked about, how you would set it if you're
okay.
open to
All
that.
Right.
It's
sure,
just a little
sure.
tiny bit. It's just a sentence.
Okay.
So this is Barbara Crooker's poem, In the Middle.
Okay.
And here's the sentence.
Okay.
In the middle of a life that's as complicated as everyone else's, struggling for balance, juggling time.
Oh, that like falls right into a meter.
Yeah,
it's, in my head.
Right, you hear the word stresses.
Yeah.
So you're starting to think like a composer already, right? In the middle of a life that's as complicated as everyone else's, struggling for balance, juggling time.
I mean, frankly, it feels like cheating.
That's a sign of a good poem to set to music, is when you look at it and the music just jumps off the page at you and you start hearing rhythms and melodies and harmonies.
But that's really cool that's how you go to, like, you're letting the text literally speak to you.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
write the music. That's really cool.
So we talked a little bit about mood, uh-huh. and obviously this one's very different from The Road Home or yeah. from Threshold of Night. So in the middle of a life that's as complicated as everyone else's, struggling for balance, juggling time. So how would you maybe, what kind of mood would you go for if you were setting this piece?
Gosh, I mean,
put you on the spot.
It sounds really, it's kind of an epic thought. So,
yeah,
you know, like it makes me think of very big sounding music, very... my vocabulary has officially failed me.
That's fine. I just taught you how to maybe send music. So there's no right answers. So
yeah.
keep that in mind. When we look at the same text and two composers setting it, that
yeah.
usually it's very different. Sometimes there's similarities with the rhythm, like we talked about, but
yeah.
Yeah.
It makes me think of like Arcade Fire, maybe. It has that kind of mood that they sometimes have in their work that's sort of what is the word? I mean, epic is what it is, but it's kind of like bombastic
yeah.
sounding. It's kind of like it really drives home the depth of meaning in the words. Like that's like they
yeah.
warrant that kind of big sound.
Yeah.
So yeah.
So if you want, we can hear how I said it.
Yeah.
There's one. So when you listen, I did for the words struggling and juggling.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of weird. I hear struggling as being two syllables, although some people say struggling.
Uh-huh.
But I do say juggling. So struggling has two syllables and juggling has three.
Yeah.
I had to make a decision there and I went with my gut instinct and maybe it was wrong. But I'm happy with it. But those two words, since they rhyme on the page... they actually do sort of rhyme in the music. There's the same music for both of them. So okay. we can hear how I solved this yeah. sentence.
Did the text actually come back around and say time again, or was that your
yeah.
own? Okay.
You're right. The text doesn't do that, but I did that, and there's a reason why.
Okay, tell
and
me.
And that's a whole different thing too. Is when do we repeat the words?
Yeah.
When do we not repeat the words? And how do we decide?
Does this make the writers angry? When you add things to their work.
Yeah, no, some writers do not like it.
Okay.
I'm lucky that so far I've worked with writers who are okay with it. But the reason that it's there twice is because the word time actually comes back in this poem a lot. So one of my solutions to this piece being through composed mm-hmm. and free verse, right? So my having to kind of find my own way through it because there is no set form or meter or anything. One thing I did is every time the word comes back, it's set more or less the same way. So mm-hmm. that was with that kind of descending figure that we heard.
I see. Okay.
So if you want, we could jump to the end of this piece and
yeah,
look at that.
Yeah,
So here's the text for that.
Okay.
We'll never get there. Time is always ahead of us, running down the beach, urging us on faster, faster. But sometimes we take off our watches. Sometimes we lie in the hammock, caught between the mesh of rope and the net of stars, suspended, tangled up in love, running out of time.
Huh.
And that's it.
That's great.
Yeah. So when I looked at this, there's so much potential for text painting in everything we talked about, right?
Uh-huh.
Like rhythm and melody and harmony. Like what kind of harmony would represent stars or love or lie in the hammock?
Mm-hmm.
But the cool thing about this part is the whole time the piano has been kind of speeding us up and slowing us down.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the other thing too. If we're writing for chorus and another instrument, we have to find a reason for that instrument to exist. So what is the purpose of that instrument? Why is it there?
Really? You have to justify that in this kind of music writing?
Only to yourself. And I think this way, and I don't think everyone thinks this way. I think some people just think like, there's a piano because there's a piano, but I'm always like, what is it doing there? And what
I see,
okay. like, how does it fit into the text and how is it going to help propel us along?
So you have a very like purist approach to
sort of, yeah.
Chrome
yeah.
Music. Okay.
Yeah. So for this, the piano ends up being kind of like a timekeeper, almost like a metronome. Do you know what a metronome is?
Yeah.
Yeah,
the,
right. So
the ticking
thing.
Clicks.
Yeah, it clicks back and forth. So the piano is almost like a really unreliable metronome
mm-hmm.
where it starts out with that rigid melody we heard in the beginning, and then it starts flowing, and then it goes abruptly back in time, and it's kind of supposed to reflect the way that we perceive life passing, where some moments mm-hmm. are going by really quickly and some feel like we are caught up in the moment.
Mm-hmm.
So in this one little tiny bit of text, we do all of those things. So we're getting faster, faster, and then at sometimes we take off our watches. The poem itself, there are all these commas all over the place. Sometimes we take off our watches. Sometimes we lie in the hammock,
mm-hmm.
caught between the mesh of rope and the net of stars, suspended, tangled up in love, running out of time. And I love how Barbara wrote this because the words get a little more complicated and we have to take time to say them
mm-hmm.
instead of running down the beach, which is really easy to say really fast, right?
Yeah.
Running down the beach. And as we talked about earlier with text painting, again, question to you, how would you maybe set running down the beach? If it was a melody, what's...
Running down the beach.
Running down the beach.
Yeah.
Yeah. And what could you do with the notes, maybe? Very leading questions
dun, dun,
here.
Dun, 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 dun. Yeah.
You could do it. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, sorry, I'm totally putting you on the spot here.
That's okay.
But so I think we could listen to this and hear how all of those things come together. The piano is pushing us on and then letting us slow down.
Okay.
And then here the music itself sort of runs out of time. Like it just keeps going and then it stops kind of abruptly.
So this sort of cleverness is, I'm finding, very characteristic of this kind of music. We've had another guest on the show, Keith Weber, who talks, he's talked to me about choral music too. And and like once he explained to me what was going on in the music, I was like, that is pretty cool. Like, I mean, the thought that goes into that, you know, the running down the beach, like all of a sudden the music is running, you know?
Yeah.
But I had to have that explained to me, you know? And I wonder, this is a really obtuse question, but how much do you think that cleverness is getting to listeners, and how much do you think is just lost on them and just, they're just sort of mentally glossing it over? And do you think that matters?
So I think it's kind of like poetry, where we can read it on the surface or we can take time and look at the craft behind it and see what's brilliant about how the words are strung together. And part of with choral music, too, is hard because there's a lot of people singing at once and they're trying to get everything lined up in a lot of places, so it's exactly the same happening at the same time. And sometimes that doesn't happen. With very good choirs, it always happens. But another thing composers do sometimes is they don't necessarily let us hear every word as it's happening.
Mm-hmm.
So we don't get a very clear idea of the text. Now here I'm reading the text to you before we hear, right?
Right, yeah.
But it would actually, I don't know, it would be an interesting exercise to listen to some choral music and see if you could hear what they're saying without knowing what the text was. And maybe we could try that. but I think that gets in the way a lot, too, with some choral writing and some choral singing. But usually it's the fault of the composer, where we can't get into what the words are and what the meaning is and what the all of what you called cleverness, right? All of the little things that the composer is thinking about and trying to express in the music. If we don't hear what the words are, there's no point of entry for the listener, right?
Mm-hmm.
If they've read the text before, and usually you get a program, and it's got program notes, and like my program notes for that piece say the piano is kind of like a timekeeper that's unreliable, right? So you might be able to listen for that. And a lot of program notes have the text too, so you can read it first or read it as the choir is singing. But I do think it's the job of the composer to make the words really clear.
Yeah.
Right? So that we actually can hear what's going on. And that's one thing that pop and rock music do usually really well. Sometimes you get like pop singers where you have no idea what they're saying.
Right, you get Kurt Cobain who you can't understand at all.
Yeah, there's all those like websites with misheard lyrics and things, right? Right. Like the wrong, But choir, you could do the same thing with choir music, a lot of it.
That's
just, what are they saying? But that's never, my goal is always to know exactly what they're saying.
That is such a different way of listening to music. Like it's such a, it's like really listening on purpose.
Yeah.
You know, like as opposed to casually, like it requires it sounds like it requires a lot of participation on the part of the listener.
It does. It does. Mm. And that's one, I guess that's one, again, like barrier to entry for classical music. But
because you have to do stuff.
You have to actually be actively listening. Yeah. Yeah, which is, it's always kind of funny when people are like, oh, I listen to classical music, like when I'm studying or when I'm, you know, when I'm doing work and when I'm, and I'm always like, well, it's kind of, I have trouble. I cannot like type words while I listen to classical music because my brain starts listening in that active way.
Yeah.
And I just can't do both things
this
at the same
is,
time.
I hear this from composers a lot who, well, like John Luther Adams, I was just reading a little thing with him in Runner's World, and he was talking about how when he runs, like a lot of people like to run to his music, but he doesn't run to any music.
Yeah.
And I think for that same reason, where it's like, you know, you're, because you're just paying attention to the music, you can't help it. Your brain is just made that way.
Can't. And right. I don't mean to sound snobby about it, too. Like, I almost wish I could listen to it as background noise and just have it be beautiful and wash over me. But I'm always like, oh, this part's coming back now. Like, oh, we heard this before.
That doesn't
and
sound like, snobby at all.
It's transformed and it's in a different key. And, oh, they're playing with a meter here. It's just an ongoing stream of thoughts. Yeah. I forgot to say the name of the chorus singing that last piece is Choral Arts Initiative. And the ones that you mentioned in the intro are coming out with an album of my music in January, which I'm super excited about.
That's very cool. So well, let's take us out on one last piece of music and give an intro of what we're going to hear.
Yeah, so this last one is Spiritus Mundi, and the poet is Amy Fleury, who's another living author who writes and lives in Louisiana. Mm-hmm. And maybe we'll listen to the music first with this one, and you can see if you can actually hear what they're saying.
Okay, I'm going to pay really, really intense attention. I literally have no idea what they're saying. I'm assuming that it is like in Dutch or something, and I'm just not.
It's in English. No, it is hard, even when there's really amazing diction, and even whenever. And this is a great choir too. It's the Golden Bridge Choir, and Susie Digby's the conductor. But yeah, you're right. It is really hard, and that's where I think, again, it's the composer's job, but it certainly helps to have things like the program with the text in it first, or for you to even read the text even if you're just listening at home, to find the text and read it and then listen to the piece, because you'll get, I think, so much more out of it.
Yeah.
That way.
Man, I have learned so much in this episode.
That's good.
Well, like, I mean, like, seriously, I've never really thought of like how actively you really need to participate in classical music to fully appreciate it, to really get out of it everything that's there.
Though there's also, like, with poems, right, you can also just read a poem and get a sense of it and a feeling from it. And you don't necessarily have to go all English major on it.
Sure.
You know, deconstruct. So I think choral music especially is the same way, where some people think it's, you know, it's beautiful and they let it wash over them. And it's... You can enjoy it that way,
right?
Too,
you can listen
to
it on different levels.
Yeah,
unless you're right, in which case you're cursed and you
only
can't.
One level.
Yeah,
it is. Composers are cursed. It's a good curse.
Dale Trumbor, this has been so much fun. Thanks for introducing me to this music, and we'll look forward to your album coming out in January 2017.
Yeah, thank you so much again for having me on. And I'm glad that you feel like you've learned something about choral music.
That's
good. That was the goal.
All right, thanks, Dale. All right, everybody, that does it for this episode of Classical Classroom. For more Classroom, go to houstonpublicmedia.org/classroom, click on our social media links, and be amazed! Email me at dclay@houstonpublicmedia.org. Subscribe to, rate us, and review us on iTunes, for it is written that you should. Thanks to audio producer Todd Twitty Hulslander for twiddling knobs today. Thanks to editor Mark DiClaudio for his piercing Johnny Cash eyes. Thanks to Dale Trumbore for being on the show today, and to engineer Jeff Peters for his help over there at Marketplace Studios with the show today. Thanks to me for saying words, but most of all, thanks to you for listening. We will catch you next time. Hey listeners, it's Dacia again. So if you enjoy our classical music podcast, you should check out Houston Public Media's new podcast called Encore Houston. It's hosted by one of my favorite classical music nerds, Joshua Zinn, who's also been on our show, by the way, and it highlights great classical music played by groups right here in Houston. You are going to love it, and you can find it on iTunes. That's Encore Houston.